Fire Department. QRI. Good evening, you guys. K2 Romeo, India Whiskey here. At this time, I'm hearing music in the background. Let me see where it's coming from.
Sounds from the repeater, and the repeater is having a problem due to the influence of this station.
Yeah, it's not coming. At first I thought it was coming from my station. I'm looking around the house. Where's that music coming from? Okay. At this time, we begin the technical event. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. And for the last 31 years and 1 month, a bunch of guys gather in the New York City area to discuss their favorite hobby, ham radio. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio, and many of those kinds get discussed. And these guys teach each other how all this equipment works and how to make it work better. We tried to, all those years, tap into this, what we think is a very large amount of brain power that exists on the East Coast equivalent of Silicon Valley, meaning the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut area, the New York City area, where quite a bit of that kind of industry takes place. Not quite as much as takes place in Silicon Valley, but it comes close, and Mayor Bloomberg is making very serious attempts to create greater technology in the New York City area. Let me drop. Interesting that that music only comes through when a signal is present on the...
It's 92.7.
Oh! So, Eric, after I give out my monologue, I'll turn it over to you for a little bit of an explanation as to where it's coming from. Of the 26 kinds of ham radio we discuss, ham radio of the 2-meter FM variety, and quite a few of the others get involved. One of the things you'll be hearing about tonight is that Lou, NY2H, made a very interesting statement this week. I'll be telling you guys about that. I've also discovered an extremely nice article way back in High Frequency Electronics magazine, the February 2007 issue, page 50, has a very nice article about electrically small antennas. Some of the questions that Eric has been asking and others have been asking, and I've been saying for a long time, what happens when you got an extremely small dipole, like a quarter of a wavelength, a tenth of a wavelength, a twentieth of a wavelength, a dipole, what happens? And this very, very nice article written in good English, good little engineering English from my point of view. I've requested that Bernie, let me drop. Requested that Bernie give you both the URL where you can go to the article directly if you like from a High Frequency Electronics magazine, or I've also given him a PDF copy of the article itself. So on Bernie's website, which is bernie@huntfamily.org, you'll be able to eventually see a copy of this. Unfortunately, I gave this information to Bernie only an hour or so ago, so quite possibly he hasn't had a chance to load it onto his website yet, but as soon as he does, it's worth looking at, in my opinion. So, how antennas really work is not very well described by almost any of the colleges that I know of that teach electrical engineering, wireless engineering, and communications electronics in general. They do, by my standards, an extremely poor job of teaching antennas, as such that antennas are not that much rocket science. Let me drop. By way of some of the ham radio literature you have access to, like ARL's antenna book, or by talking to your fellow amateurs who tinker and build antennas, as I said, it's not rocket science. What makes an antenna work doesn't require a doctorate degree and a whole lot of years of study. To do a real good job of designing antennas, that study and that apprenticeship would be required. But a person cannot come out of any of the colleges I know of in the United States, walk out of there with a bachelor or a master's degree, and earn a living designing antennas. And that's a shame, because all of this wireless electronics we use would all fall flat on its face and go nowhere without connecting it to an antenna. No matter how perfect the transmitter and the receiver is, without an antenna, you've got nothing. So you would think that rather than barely mention the word antenna at the last week of the electrical engineering course in your senior year, let me drop. As I said, they just barely mention the word antenna, and a subject that important should be discussed a hell of a lot more And they spend all kinds of time teaching you how a Smith chart works and how transmission lines work, which is one of the components that feeds the antenna. So it's the transmitter or the receiver. But the bottom line, where it all happens, is in the antenna. And it's just barely mentioned. Terrible. And then when they do mention it with the Maxwell's equations and three-dimensional electronics, three-dimensional matrix equations, which is not useful engineering form. Essentially, no antenna engineer designs an antenna by directly using Maxwell's equations. It's a little bit like that funny expression they make for what is statistics? Statistics is to a drunk, statistics is to an engineer what a lamppost is to a drunk. It's used more for support than for illumination. Used more for support than for illumination. Does a guy study those equations and suddenly get an aha statement in his head, and all of a sudden he goes out and builds an antenna? Absolutely not. So we amateurs teach each other that, and we go to the better engineering departments of any of the companies that have an engineering department that's devoted to antennas, and you'll find a copy of the antenna handbook from ARRIL. Let me drop. The statement that Lou made this week, which is very insightful, he's added on to my 20 bounce theory, if you know what I mean. So we'll be discussing that. And as I said, we'll be discussing this article. The menu we've come up with after 30 years, we've slowly evolved into a menu that we try to follow. We're not super good at it, but that menu is we take sign-ins from people who do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just because you're listening. There are nets where great big long lists of people sign in saying that I'm listening. Well, after 30 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. We save time by avoiding that. So with questions or comments, you sign in. We try to give a quasi-brief answer, not necessarily very brief, during that first hour or so, maybe hour and a half. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, who chooses a few of the best, most universal questions he's gotten through his mailbag. Let me drop. So John sends KC2WG, they send him emails, snail mails, and carrier pigeon messages as to what questions they desire. And last week, John hit a record. 283 emails were mailed to John saying, please discuss this subject on the technical net. Now, some of those emails are a little bit preposterous, way beyond what was volunteered. There are some people, for instance, who will send us their college homework in electrical engineering and ask us to review it for them. That's beyond the call of duty. We haven't volunteered for that. And so we have not volunteered a written consulting service that you're going to get free of charge just because you sent an email to the technical net. If the subject you've asked is of sufficient universal value, John will bring it forward, and we discuss it on the net. So after John, the next thing we do is to have Paul, WS2N, who is our space expert, tell us what what NASA, National Aeronautics and Space Administration, has been doing for the last week or so. Let me drop. And I keep bringing up that beautiful piece of electronics that was created way back in 1976. That's when it was launched. Called Voyager, and Voyager is out there 3 times the distance to Pluto, way outside of the solar system, something like 12 billion miles away. At the speed of light, it takes the signal from Voyager to get to the Earth 17 hours one way. That thing is really out there. And miles per watt, a 20-watt transmitter from that distance, is really doing magic by my standards. It's a beautiful proof of what I've been saying for a long time. You issue a transmitted radio signal, it goes to every place in the universe. You can't stop it from doing that. It's going to get weak in a very predictable manner. Inverse square law, the signal goes down 4 to 1 in power every time you double the distance. That's what you receive, 1/4 of the power every time you double the distance. Well, you can't be doubling the distance very fast anymore when you're going out there to 3 times the distance to Pluto. And so lots of people used to think that a radio signal going that far would get tired. It doesn't. That signal, you can predict to the nearest fraction of a dB after 12 billion miles exactly how strong that signal is going to be when you pick it up with the Goldstone dish. And that's not very complicated mathematics, believe it or not. Let me drop. But from time to time, I ask John once again, what's the latest with Voyager? By the radiation detector that's on Voyager right now, there's lots of strong evidence that it has thoroughly left the solar system. It's no longer seeing the solar wind being boiled off by the sun. It's now seeing galactic wind. And the prediction is that at the rate it's going, at the rate its nuclear power supply is very slowly failing, at the rate at which the traveling wave tube on board is very slowly going down in power output, most likely we will still be listening to the signal from Voyager as it's traveling out there at a zillion miles an hour moving away from us. We probably will be talking to it, literally talking to it round trip, giving it orders and getting signals back as to what it sees and what it sounds like and what it looks like, probably to the year 2022, 2024, somewhere 10 or so years from now, we'll still be talking about Voyager. It will still be the chunk of electronics that mankind created, the chunk of space hardware that by far has gone further and faster than almost anything else we've ever created. It's the top of the heap, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So that's sort of the menu, and after Paul tells us what's going on in space, we get a little bit deeper into some of the subjects. When we go into the deeper subjects, let me make a request. There are times when people will give us a fairly long dissertation as to their interpretation of something. I think we should try to go a little easy on that. In other words, the way the technical net is set up and the way that people are able to respond, if a person gives us a real question, in other words, hey, I see such and such, I'd like to know what that means, or I'd like to know how do I make this work better. So in the form of a question is a much better format for the technical net rather than a long discussion of your impression of something that you've seen, if you know what I mean. But that's just a suggestion. Okay, we take check-ins at this time. A person gives John, Hal, me, and John, and Paul, gives us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sound like this, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, Joe, and yes. So call letters, name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. Try to remember, each time I hand it back to you guys, try to remember to listen to all four beeps and 1 or 2 seconds beyond. Let me drop. One of the complaints we get almost every week is we're so quick on the gun that somebody who is also trying to sign in by way of Echolink or IRLP, the people from the outer fringes, so to speak, in another state, another country, because we're so quick jumping the gun, they don't get a chance to sign in, and they get selected out, if you know what I mean. So try not to jump the gun if not. I really pass it over to you. You've got some time. You don't have to grab it real fast to make sure that you don't lose your turn, if you know what I mean.
Quick comment, Dick.
Hey, go right ahead, John. Give us a comment on that. And I'm also going to turn it over to Eric to give us a little bit of explanation for where the music is coming from, if he desires to. KC2WG, go right ahead, John.
Dick, I just want to let you know we're not working with the 900. I don't know if you're aware of that. So we will have the delay, and it's going to be a little tough for the guys coming in on the east.
I just decided to listen to a hole, sure enough. I dialed into the wrong channel. Sure enough, there's a delay. So because of that delay, to a person who is on eastern Long Island, where he has to sign into the eastern input of this machine, 147.375, where there is, let me see right now, hello? Wow, about 3 seconds of delay right now. And sometimes that delay builds up even more. So unless we, I get the impression that unless we drop for all four beeps and a couple of seconds beyond, the person signing on the eastern input might not get a chance to do that. Let's see what Eric's going to say about all of the above, the delay, the 900 megs, and the music that we're hearing. And it's a rather minor amount of music. I can just barely hear it because I'm wearing earphones and I'm running full duplex mode. KE2EJ. Our technical maven of this net, K2RIW, of this network, K2RIW. W. You got it, Eric.
K2RW, K3J. Hello, Dick. By the way, K3J, Eric, yes. The music is actually, my entire system is sitting under the antenna. That is a full power FM station. And they speak Spanish. And we're getting a little rectification in some of the audio cables. It's new for whatever reason. I haven't had the opportunity to go up there yet. They may have up their power. They're probably running their full 10 kilowatt TPO out of the transmitter. Let me drop. And something changed recently. As far as the 900 goes, I have a problem with that. I haven't had the opportunity to go search and find and repair. This could be a PL problem. It could be a an appearance problem, but essentially what happens is the link is unreliable. It drops out in the middle of somebody talking. I mean, I could have lost an amplifier only hitting it with, you know, fractions of a watt instead of the full blast that we need to cover the distance to the travel. Going back to that original question that I had for you, I have a new question, which is a clarification or something, but you'll get to it. K2RW, K2J.
Okay, Eric is on the list. I'm going to take check-ins at this time. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes if you do have a question or a comment. So please sign in right now. K2RW listening.
WH1YY, Joe, yes.
Enter HCN, Wesley, yes, after Paul. Not having any time question about the new subject.
Okay, so far we've got Eric, Joe, and Wes. Anyone else to sign in with a question or a comment for the net? Please give me your call letters and name and the word yes right now. Okay. And also I know that there was a Hoosark meeting, in other words, a flea market tonight, today, there was a flea market at the Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club. And I think there was also a bit of a conflict because of the Pink Committee, I think it's called. In other words, people gathering with reference to breast cancer or some other cause like that created a huge traffic jam. So I think people had some trouble getting to the Hall of Science Radio Club. So anybody who wants to give us a description of that later on, I'll give a request for what great deals, what was it like at the Hall of Science Amateur Radio Flea Market or convention this Sunday. I'll be asking that particular question. Alrighty, I'm going to take Joe first because I know that when we get into Eric's subject, it's going to get a little bit more elaborate. Although sometimes Joe asks questions. I'm going to take Joe first and then Eric in that order. Joe, W-H-Y-Y. What chunk of electronics do you think we should be discussing tonight, Joe? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, you think I'm going to fool you and come up here with an elaborate question, right? Of course I am. Keep you thinking. This is a continuation of what I brought up, the subject I brought up on the TechNet last week about interference of intermodal transmitters. And you had mentioned something about a PA being able to re-radiate a signal, but only when it was on, assuming that it's part of a transmitting system. And I have a comment on that. What's the question and comment? What happens with these types of systems that are built up by some people who take a mobile radio, feed it into an amplifier, into a duplexer, and an antenna at some of these locations, and because they put something cheap together, you know, they sneak something up in a building somewhere. And these PAs are not, they have 12 volts on them, but they don't have anything exciting in them. When they're not being transmitted, but they still have a DC excitation going to the PA. Now, I would think these things are also susceptible to receiving high-energy RF coming down and re-radiating a signal. That probably becomes a much tougher challenge to try to find as far as the source, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, you've used some good common sense on that one, Joe. The way you
you and I operate a transmitter normally, is that our final stage of our transmitter, in many cases, the P-plus gets applied at the same time you push the torque switch and you excite the whole rig and you start driving that final stage. And so it becomes active, and it's thoroughly inactive in some cases, drawing no current, getting no B-plus, when you don't push the torque switch. Many of our rigs work that way. I'll admit that commercial rigs might not. If the final stage is truly active, and I'm going to give you two or three examples of what I mean by truly active, really driven with a signal, running Class A or Class C, almost doesn't matter. It's a beautiful mixer for anything coming back down the antenna into that transmitter. Anything coming back into the back end of the transmitter, you're going to get mixing products. There's a couple of variables that can make those mixing products a little bit stronger, a little bit weaker, but if you use a rough rule of thumb, worst case engineering, and you assume that the signal hitting the back door of the transmitter is going to be mixed, and the mixed product, if it's a third order intermon, is probably going to be 8 or so dB weaker than the signal you put in. You put in a plus 30 dBm signal, you're going to get a plus 22 dBm signal out of it, so to speak. Now, if the final stage has B plus on it, and if it's truly running Class C, Class C is usually defined as the input section. If it was the grid of a tube or the base of a transistor, it's twice beyond cutoff, is the usual definition of Class C. Now, without drive, the final transistor, although it's got B plus on it, draws no current. In that case, even though B plus is there, in my opinion, it's rather strongly inactive that a signal being poured in is going to get very little mixing
active. Repeater, timeout.
Yeah, I got to be careful about that timeout. A signal poured into the back end of a transmitter that is thoroughly inactive, not drawing any current, because it's running Class C, twice beyond cutoff, and no drive signal is there, I believe very little mixing action will take place. However, if that final stage is running Class A, a Class A stage, by definition, always draws current. It's always electronically active, whether it's driven or not. And remember, we were speculating last week that whether the transmitter be a 50 kilowatt transmitter, a 50 watt transmitter, or a 50 milliwatt transmitter, in either case, in any of those cases, you pour signals in, you're going to get close to the same kind of mixing action. There's variations, of course. So as long as the electronics of the final stage is truly active, if that collector is drawing current, if that plate is drawing current, whether it be Class A and it's sitting there and it's not driven yet, or if it's Class C and it's being driven, then you're going to get mixing. And without that current, without that switching action of that final stage going on, I don't think you're going to get very much mixing. That's my belief. And
can I correct you?
Yeah, go right ahead, Eric. Let's see what you've lived in that world, Eric, and a lot more than I have. So give us your impression on this one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2LIW, K2EJ. You know, we're talking Class C here for a second. On one hand, I agree with you, and that is if you have a single-stage transistor, okay, as your alpha transistor. But if you're typically, like most amplifiers, got a pair, either a push-pull or a parallel pair, the bias on the transistor, there's going to be an idling bias, that is, so it's always drawing current, and maybe, you know, if you're talking big power like I am, it might be 500 milliamps, or even a smaller amplifier might be 50 milliamps, so it's always in the conduction zone for half the time, so yeah, you can get mixing products out of it, and I've seen it happen. K2IWK to the junk.
6DPZ with a comment. Hal recognized, and Eric, I agree with you. Once again, I'm trying to say that if those final stages, the collectors of the transistors, the tubes, a plate circuit, or whatever, whether it's drawing standby bias current, Class A current, or whatever, if it is electronically active, then it's capable of doing mixing. If it was a truly Class C transistor, tube-type amplifier, a pair of 4CX250Bs running truly Class C, where until a drive signal arrives, no current flows through that plate, then I think very little mixing action would take place. And you're still going to get a little bit of it mixing action with solid state, because solid state devices, when they're thoroughly turned off, in other words, no current is being drawn, but still the signal you pour in is giving you a little bit of what's called C-swing as you're changing instantaneous voltage between plate and collector and base. As you change the voltage between the collector and the base by way of the signal fed in backwards, you are getting a small amount of capacitance variation, the varector diode characteristic, so to speak, and you're going to get some mixing. I believe it's going to be quite a number of dB weaker, but there's going to be some mixing action. I bet you've seen quite a bit of this reversed signal flowing back down the antenna on transmitters, creating grief, and therefore the circulator is highly required. I bet you run into that, Hal. K6DPZ, HRIW, go ahead, Hal.
K6DPZ. I just wanted to mention on Clan Sisters, you don't bias them off for Class C. They're already biased off, and when you drive them, they go into a pulse Class C operation. There's no two times cutoff. That was my only comment, Dick.
No, that depends upon the design now.
Generally, in Class C, you don't bias the transistor. It's going to be hard, cold, and when it's driven, it'll conduct. You don't have to put a cutoff bias on the transistor.
You tell that to a number of FM radio stations that my TV transmitters.
In the case of a 4CX250B tube running Class C, you do put minus 90 volts on that control grid, and it is biased approximately twice beyond cutoff. In some cases, in some transistorized amplifiers, they might put some negative bias voltage on the base, but I agree with you. You've got quasi-Class C with no bias at all, because on most, I guess you would call it enhancement mode transistors, until you do something active, it draws no current. There are depletion mode FET transistors, though, with no bias current, with no bias voltage, are drawing current. So there's a fair number of variations here. The bottom line of all this is that for you to think that you're safe because that final stage is biased beyond cutoff, even Class B or Class C, and therefore when the transistor stage is not being driven, you're not going to be doing mixing. You're playing with fire as I see it. If you're in a dense environment, let me drop. If your transmitter is in a dense environment on the top of the building, sharing that piece of real estate with 330 or 300 other transmitters, if every single one of those transmitters in that locale is not using good circulators and good filtering to make sure that none of those signals can roar down the amplifier, roar down the antenna and feed line in the reverse direction and hit that transmitter, you want to make sure that cannot happen. Otherwise, you're going to create grief to all your other co-residents of that location. And when they finally find out what you did to them because you didn't obey that rule, there's a chance you're going to be kicked off that site. You're going to be blackballed. You're going to be exiled. You're going to be fined. You're going to be chastised. You're going to be kicked in the tail. You're going to be punched in the nose. And you're going to make yourself extremely unpopular. You get the impression that you don't want to do that. That's a pretty strongly felt opinion. Anyone who want to add to that before I turn it back to Jay? Here we go. Joe, who asked the original question. Anybody wants to add to that, give me a call. That is right now, KQRIW in the TechNet. Okay, I think you got the impression on that one, Joe, so be careful. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K2-R-I-W, go ahead, Joe.
Okay, no, I just wanted to just bring another thing up, because I've heard of people putting these kind of things together. And bring them up to the top of these buildings, whether it's like, you know, one person knows that they're there, nobody else knows that they're there, and they don't have like two nickels rubbed together to be able to do everything the right way, so they do it their way, and as long as they have a repeater up on top of the building that's transmitting, that's all they really care about. That's all. Back to you, Dick.
If you're the technical maven of a ham radio club, and somebody really shines on you and favors you and gives you permission to put your repeater device on top of their building, treat that permission with reverence. Make sure you obey all the rules. Make sure you've got control of your harmonics. Make sure you've got a good circulator. Make sure you've got good filtering. Do all the right things so you don't make a nuisance of yourself. Make sure you've got a well-adjusted duplexing filter and so on. You don't want to skimp on that because you don't want to give a black eye to ham radio. We hams have, in general, been very good at self-policing the quality of the electronics that we put on somebody else's building so that ham radio doesn't get a black eye, so that the, somebody in the future doesn't say, I'm going to let all these commercial services up there, but I'm not going to let any hams because I've got this one bad experience. Make sure you're not the guy to create that bad experience and give us a black eye. All righty. The next guy with a question was Eric. And after I hear your question, Eric, and after we discuss that a little bit, I'll discuss what an interesting statement that was made by Hal. Here we go. Lou, NY2H, made a very interesting statement this week, adding to a couple of my little quickie, what am I going to call it now, ways of explaining the way antennas work. And I'm, from now on, I'm going to be using it and hopefully give Lou some credit for what he said. But go right ahead with your further question, Eric. And by the way, there's one other thing I have to make a correction. Let me drop
back.
In the example I gave last week where I said that a 100-watt transmitter on 10 gigahertz and a 100-watt transmitter on 100 megacycles, 100-to-1 ratio between the two, by the way, I said that the safe distance by the old standard of 10 milliwatts per square centimeter was 11.8 feet. That's true, but I forgot to take the square root. The answer is about 3.6 feet. When you take the 11.8 and take square root of it, I haven't actually done it, but it's in that neighborhood. So the real distance at which you get 192 volts per meter, 10 milliwatts per square centimeter, when you're standing broadside from a dipole with 100 watts into it, regardless of frequency, 3.5 feet away. Believe it or not, that's approximately the so-called dangerous distance from a cell site. If you were on the hook and ladder, 100 feet high, standing on the top of that ladder, and they position the ladder so that you are 5 feet or greater from the cell site antennas, and you're doing this at the time of drive time, the so-called rush hour, when everybody's on the cell site calling their wife saying, should I pick up a loaf of bread? Let me drop. You're standing directly in front of the antenna at its altitude, right in this main beam, and you're 5 feet away by the current radio frequency biohazard standards of the United States, Europe, Japan, Australia, and so on, most of the so-called developed nations. You will be below the milliwatts per square centimeter or the watts per square meter or the watts per kilogram, any of the rating systems you want to be. If you are 5 feet from that antenna, it is, by all the standards we know of, safe. Hard to believe. And you talk to any of the people in a town who find out that a cell site is going to be put up within 500 feet of a place of worship, a school, or a place of residence, and they say, not in my backyard, I can't stand the radiation, I'm going to be getting cancer and whatever. And I could repeat the situation that happened in France. I won't go there right now. So the people who are worrying about that are really misunderstanding the physics. But I know I'm off to one side here, Eric. Go ahead with your further questions and comments. KE2EJ. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Eric.
K2RIW, K2J. All right. This is all based on the previous discussions that we've had. And this is kind of really an esoteric question in terms of where I'm going with one particular thing. I've done the math of a number of different antennas, and actually I could have used NEC, but I did it by hand. Calculated the E field, the H field, the near field, the far field, and all that good stuff. And that worked out very well for some very short antennas. It very surprising that the numbers actually worked. But now I want to zero in on something that's almost meaningless. It came down to when we were talking about the impedance of free space. Let me let it drop. I ran across a formula, which I'm going to give to you. It's very simple. And there's a statement that goes with it. And it basically says all antennas have a radiation resistance, which is the resistance the antenna presents to the circuit due to radiation. The radiation resistance of an elementary doublet in free space is, and here we go, okay, that radiation is equal to 2 pi over 3, close your eyes and jot this down, 2 pi over 3 times the impedance of free space times the square root of delta L, which is the length of the conductor, over the wavelength squared. Okay. Now, the thing that's irking me is that we've come back to agreeing that the impedance of free space is essentially zero ohm. You plug in zero and the whole thing falls apart. K2RIW, K2J, I guess what I'm asking is, do you see any value in the way that you present it?
Okay, you may be misquoting us a little bit there, Eric, when you said that we came to the conclusion that free space has an impedance of zero ohms. I know I didn't say that. I'm saying that to a degree you can consider free space 377, particularly when it comes to radiation that you're picking up with a kind of detector that is purely thermal. If I take quasi-optical, in other words, I'm at a high enough radio frequency or at an optical frequency where I use normal lensing techniques to do focusing, and I put it into a kind of detector which is going to be a resistive card that has some number of ohms per square, and if I want to absorb the maximum amount of energy on the first pass from that signal being focused onto my thermal detector, then if I set it up as 377 ohms over 2, and the reason for the 2 is because that resistive card, it sees 377 ohms to the north, it sees 377 ohms to the south, in other words, both sides of the card, and those two chunks of space from the card's point of view are in parallel, therefore it becomes 189 ohms. You set up the card to 189 ohms per square of resistivity, and you will get maximum absorption of that energy. And so if I'm building a kind of a thermal detector, a little bit similar to your Hewlett-Packard 435 watt-meter, your power detector, then yes, that kind of impedance really does work. Let me drop. But when you start now using a dipole-like antenna, or a Yagi-like antenna, a horn-like antenna, a parabolic dish-like antenna, any of the things that are going to absorb energy from space, convert it into a voltage, and send that voltage down a transmission line. Now, if you think that that antenna is giving you an impedance match to space, and space is 377 ohms, there things don't seem to work out so well. What is the real impedance of space from a voltage detecting point of view? I'm not so sure, because of that example I gave last week, where a half-inch antenna at 10 gigs does a beautiful, what appears to be impedance match into space, and a 50-inch long antenna at 100 megacycles does the exact same impedance match. And so how can a piece of wire 100 times longer in one case than the other case still give you an impedance match? From my point of view, if you just look at the antenna as a standing wave structure where the energy, it's got a signal, a significant amount of Q, 10 or 20 is the Q. The signal is going to bounce back and forth 20 times before it gets radiated. And whether or not it gets radiated is a function of whether or not you shielded the antenna. Let me drop. If you built your dipole inside of the outer copper coating of a piece of Andrew Heliac's cable, then the apparent impedance at the center of your half-wave dipole will be zero ohms, because the signal traveling down the so-called dipole didn't get radiated, and all of it bounced back out of phase, half wavelength later, quarter wave down, quarter wave back, and it gives you what looks like a short circuit. make that piece of wire infinitely long, as you would with a beverage or a rhombic antenna, and now the impedance is a much, much higher number. But so the radiation, the percentage of radiation seems to be the major determining factor of what impedance you see. And so impedance matching to space is a little bit more difficult to justify. Impedance matching to space implies that it is resistive. The 377 ohms everyone talks about is a resistor. Let me drop. Is there really a resistor out there in space? In the case of a vacuum, absolutely not. In the case of the air that exists between the ionosphere and the Earth, there is a real resistive impedance there. It happens to be many megohms. And by way of the Leonard Hill experiment, Mr. Leonard Hill of the Applied Physics Laboratory had this beautiful set of articles in Flying Models magazine way back in the 50s, where you take a polonium source on each tip of the wing, each wing tip of your radio-controlled airplane. You put a polonium source out there, which gives you local ionization of the air. That's a way of connecting your ohmmeter, so to speak. And now you put a voltage-sensing device between those two wings, and as you tilt the airplane by rolling those wings, you develop a very predictable amount of voltage, and therefore you feed that voltage back. It becomes a beautiful E-field stabilizer, using the fact that there's something like 300,000 volts between the ionosphere and ground, and the air is mildly conductive, and if you've got a big enough probe, you can sense that conductivity. Let me give you a couple of words on that one. Let me drop. This resistive conductivity or resistivity of air is a volumetric resistivity. Seawater is a volumetric material. Air is a volumetric material. The dirt in your backyard is a volumetric material. So let me go to the case where you and I can do it very easily, the dirt in my backyard. I'm about to try to measure the impedance of the dirt in my backyard on an average day when it rained 3 days ago, so it's not super dry dirt. It's not super wet dirt. It's just an average day. And I've got a great big long extension set of coupe leads connected to my ohm meter. And I stick one ohm meter probe into the ground at the north end of my property. 100 feet away, I stick another ohm meter probe into the ground, and I measure the impedance between those two probes. And I'll probably measure something like 1,000 ohms. And by the way, you really should do it with AC voltage, not DC voltage, because when you put a DC voltage into something like ground, you start building up a layer of material. You start electroplating some of the stuff in the dirt onto your probe. You do it with AC, you don't do that. And you'll probably measure, I'm not sure of the exact number, something like 1,000 ohms. And you'll say, gee, 100 feet of my ground is 1,000 ohm of impedance. Well, that's not true. If you now increase the amount of probe that's in contact with the dirt by sinking a real 8-foot-long grounding rod, you'll probably measure something like 4 ohms. If you use a whole bunch of grounding rods at the north end of your property and a whole bunch of grounding rods at the south end of your property clustered together, you'll probably measure 2 ohms. In other words, the number of ohms you measure is highly dependent on the amount of area of your sensing probe in contact with the volumetric material. And so you've got to be very careful as to how you do the experiments so you really measure resistivity of the ground as opposed to the local resistance around your individual
repeater. Time out.
As opposed to the local resistance around your probe. The reason that polonium source does such a good job is because the polonium source probably ionizes the air around the right-hand wingtip of the airplane, and maybe it's a 1 foot diameter. Here it is. It's a spherical area about 1 foot or maybe half a foot in diameter around the right-hand wingtip, and the left-hand wingtip polonium source is ionizing the air around another sphere of material, and maybe it's doing it for half a foot or 1 foot. And so it gives you a real amount of contact with the with the real resistivity of the air, and you can easily sense that voltage. You could put a real metallic sphere at the right-hand wingtip and a real metallic sphere at the left-hand wingtip, and you'll measure the exact same voltage, but oh, by the way, your airplane won't fly anymore because of all the damn wind resistance you've created with those great big spheres. The nice thing about the polonium source is that it's creating the sphere electronically for you. It's ionizing the air in that vicinity. And yes, the airplane is flying at, let me drop in there, let me pick a number out of the 60 or 80 miles an hour is your radio control model airplane flight speed. Let me drop. And therefore, the air that got ionized by your polonium source, a millisecond later, that ionized air has been swept away, but the polonium source in a few microseconds is ionizing another volume of air. So the polonium source is giving you the best of both worlds. It's giving you a great big probe area in contact with the volumetric material called air that you want to measure the voltage across, and it doesn't create a hell of a lot of wind resistance in the process because the ionization takes place so rapidly. So resistivity of air, you and I can talk about. When it comes to an antenna, every antenna we've ever built, and this beautiful article that I want you guys to see, which is the February issue 2007 of High Frequency Electronics magazine on page 50. And by way of Bernie's website, Bernie at huntfamily.com, I think it is, Bernie will eventually put this article there because I requested he do so. You read that article, and you'll find out that every antenna you build has loss resistance and radiation resistance. I'm going to give a quick explanation of that. Let me drop. If you're smart enough to build your antenna out of the right kind of materials so that when you know the number of bounces that the signal is going to make before it really radiates into space, and that's a function of how many wavelengths long the antenna is, whether it's a tenth wavelength long where there's a lot of bounces or whether it is a full half wavelength where there's only 20 bounces, how much the resistance of the materials you've used. You don't want to build your dipole out of 22-gauge wire if you're trying to get super high efficiency on 80 meters, we'll say. You'd like to use a 14-gauge, 12-gauge, 10-gauge wire. As you increase the diameter of the wire, the resistance of the wire, the real ohmic resistance, including skin factor, skin effect, starts going down, and the antenna becomes higher and higher in efficiency. So there's a loss of resistance, which is a function of resistance of your materials and skin effect, and there's a real radiation resistance. And if you set it up correctly, 98% of what you're going to sense is the radiation resistance. The apparent resistance, because of the way your antenna is operating, and therefore the impedance that you see, the resistive component of the impedance that you see at the feed point. And if the antenna happens to be a half wavelength long, let me drop. If it's a half wavelength long, the impedance you see at the feed point at the center will be a pure resistance, and there'll be no reactance. You start making the antenna shorter and shorter, and in the example of this article, they go down to a tenth of a wavelength, which on 2 meters, correction, on 80 meters, would be, let's see, one-tenth of 26 feet. If you make the dipole 26 and a fraction feet long, it's a tenth of a wavelength. And I believe the article says that a good dipole in free space at that tenth of a wavelength is going to have a resistive component of 1.96 ohms and a reactive component of -J1758. 1,750 ohms of capacitive reactance because you've made it short, and that's really a function of how many bounces the signal is going to make, and the resistive component is 1.96 ohms. And as bad as that sounds, a very simple L network, a single inductor and a single capacitor, will give you a nearly perfect impedance match to that. If your real ohmic resistance of your wire, because it's got a whole lot of copper oxide on the surface, a small diameter wire, it's tarnished, and it's kind of yucky, and it was laying in the salt water for a while before you stuck it up in the air. Let me drop it. If the real ohmic resistance of your yucky wire happened to be 1.96 ohms, and the radiation resistance is 1.96 ohms, then by definition, your antenna is going to have very close to 50% efficiency. Of all the power you put into it, half of it radiated into space, and half of it created in the heat of your yucky materials, if you know what I mean. So there's where the inefficiency quite frequently takes place if you're not smart enough to consider how much is radiation resistance and what is the loss of your materials because you didn't do a good job of choosing them. So this formula you just gave us, Eric, of 2 pi over 3 times Z0 times square root of delta L over lambda squared, is that a calculation of the radiation resistance, the resistive component? Let me drop. And by way of good, hard, real evidence, I'm now talking about the Brown and Woodward curve. The Brown and Woodward curve for resistance and the Brown and Woodward curve for reactants for various lengths of monopoles. Because he got extremely different amounts of resistance depending on the diameter of the wire. That's what he really did measure. And this formula you gave me, the diameter of the wire is not there. So this is somebody's modeling equation in some kind of an ideal environment. From my point of view, it doesn't seem to represent real world very well for a couple of reasons, Eric. KE2EJ, KQLIW in the TechNet.
KQLIW, KE2EJ. Yeah, I like that explanation that you went through. That did bring a couple of thoughts to me, because it doesn't take, as you said, the diameter of the wire into consideration. There's a couple of other elements that I can think about, but, you know, what you get out of a book is one guy's interpretation of it. But based on what I just heard you say, given a real-world example, I can, by substitution and moving things around, actually calculate out the effective impedance to space. So it's now something else to try when I get a few minutes and pull out my math CAD sheet, plug that in, flip it around, and see what it says. It should be very interesting. Thank you for that, Dick. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, now would be a good time to tell you about the stroke of genius that that Lou had this week. Lou heard us talk last week about the fact that our antenna is going to have something like 20 bounces under normal conditions when it's a half wavelength long. You start making the antenna shorter and shorter. It starts becoming, it starts developing a significant capacitor reactance. A dipole always becomes a capacitor as you make it shorter than half wave. It becomes an inductor as you make it longer than half wave until you go over the hill of more than one wave. And then it goes back to capacitance again, and it cycles from there on as you make it longer and longer. So longer than half wave, at first, it's an inductor. Shorter than half wave, it's always a capacitor. And if you're willing to, in the case of it acting like a capacitor, plug an inductor in the right spot, the problem goes away. You cancel the reactants, you see nothing but the resistance that's left over. And the resistive component, you can make the resistive component of your antenna anywhere from 1 ohm to 2,000 ohms, inclusive, anywhere in between, by doing nothing but changing the length of the dipole. As you go from a hundredth of a wavelength, where it's going to be under 1 ohm, to exactly half wavelength, where it's going to be exactly 73 ohms, to as approaching one wavelength where it's going to be approaching 2,000 ohms, just simply changing the length of the wire will change the reactive component between 1 ohm and 1,000 ohms or 2,000 ohms, and you didn't have to do any fancy mechanical devices like keypads, Pi networks, what am I talking about? Folded dipole feed, delta match, gamma match, all of these fancy, elaborate, mechanical things that people go to. Let me drop.
Repeater, timeout.
If because of the restrictions of the application of the antenna, where the antenna engineer is given the demand by the project engineer that you're going to match that impedance to this particular transmitter, and this particular transmitter happens to have an output impedance of 20 ohms today, and a week from now, we're going to be using another transmitter where the output impedance is 200 ohms. And so the average antenna engineer with only a small amount of experience will think, for 20 ohms, I've got to use this very elaborate mechanical structure. For 200 ohms, I've got to use this other very elaborate mechanical structure in order to make the antenna impedance match. And if you looked at the Brown and Woodward curve, he's going to do nothing but change the length, the electrical length. And he can even take that length of wire and fold it up in various ways to squeeze it into the package. As long as he makes the electrical length of the antenna, he will achieve that many ohms of resistance in one step. Yes, in the general case, there's always going to be some reactants left over. But you plug in a reactor on the antenna across the feed point or in series. I always put the reactor across because mechanically it's easier. If you're a purist, you put the reactor, capacitor, inductor, to get rid of the reactants. You'll put that in series with the element, and you get rid of it in one step. But mechanically, to put, let's say, an inductor in series with your right-hand side of the dipole, and an inductor in series with the left-hand side of the dipole, mechanically, that's ugly. Whereas, if you suspend the dipole mechanically in the normal manner, let me drop. You put the reactor in shunt with the drive component, with the drive terminals. You get some interaction when you do that. And the article that you can read, where I give you 1,500 words on this subject, is on the bottom of the Tom Williams website, WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org. You go to that website, you go to the bottom of the page, and you'll see the dipole matching by K2RIW. You'll see the Brown and Woodward curves, and you'll see the article. You read what I said, and it tells you how to get a perfect impedance match, and I mean perfect. If you want the impedance of your dipole to be 50.000 ohms on the head, that article will tell you exactly how to get there, and how to get there in about 10 minutes. There's no magic to doing it once you know what the hell you're doing. It's not rocket science once you understand a couple of basic principles. And these basic principles are not described in any book I know of. I own 30 or 40 books on the subject of antennas, and not one of them tells you that magic, that simplicity. The real engineering useful information is not there. Craziness. And so lots of correction is required. So, once you put the reactor across the terminals, which mechanically is easiest to do, let me drop. Because of the physics of the dipole, you get some interaction. In other words, the antenna will have capacitive reactants if it's too short, or if it's a little bit longer than halfway, but will have some inductive reactants. So you put the opposite reactor across the terminals. When you put it across the terminals, you get some interaction. By that I mean the resistive component will change a little bit. Therefore, you'll retune the capacitance a little bit, or you readjust the length. So it's a two or three step process. There's a little bit of interaction, but you get there so fast, don't worry about it. And mechanically, you've got a nice, simple antenna when you do it. If you want to do it the more difficult way mechanically, but the purest way, where you cancel the reactants by putting it in series with the right side and in series with the left side of the dipole, then in one step, with no interaction, you get rid of the reactants. Which way you decide to do it is your choice. You can see which way I use most of the time. So, let's see, where was I going with that? Oh, yeah. Now, here's the magic that Lou gave us. Let me drop. In all cases except for a perfect half-wave electronic dipole, where there is no reactants left over, when the antenna is anything else, where you're going to be using the equivalent of an antenna tuner network. In other words, if you decide to make your long wire antenna 1,000 feet long, or if you decide to make your dipole or monopole a tenth of a wavelength long, in almost all cases you're going to be having some impedance where the resistive component is not what you want it to be, the reactive component is not what you want it to be. But you go to that beautiful program called Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y. You Google the word Berkeley and impedance match, Berkeley plus impedance match, plus sign, and impedance match. You'll get the Berkeley program. By way of the Brown and Woodward curve, you'll know, because of your length of antenna, exactly what impedance you're going to get. You tell Berkeley what is the impedance of your load, in other words, your antenna. You tell it the impedance of your transmitter, which might be 50 ohms resistance and no reactance. You tell Berkeley what frequency you're on, and you press go. and in a fraction of a second, Berkeley will give you 16 solutions. You choose the one that you like. The simplest solution is an L network, a simple inductor, a simple capacitor in series with each other, and you either feed the center tap and put the dipole, put the antenna on the outer end, or you feed the outer end and put the dipole in the center tap between the two components. But a simple inductor and a simple capacitor, an L network, in one step, does the impedance match for you. Now, that impedance match, ordinarily, that network is built into your antenna tuner. In some cases, it's a Pi network, in some cases, it's an L network, sometimes it's a Pi L, depends on which design you've chosen.